From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief. State of Belief can be heard across the country weekends on Air America Radio. The program and this podcast are made possible by Interfaith Alliance and its members. For more information on Interfaith Alliance and its work promoting faith and freedom throughout America, visit interfaithalliance.org. And while you're there, please consider supporting State of Belief and this free podcast service by making a tax-deductible donation to Interfaith Alliance Foundation. We need your help to keep State of Belief on the air. Thank you for listening.
Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, president of Interfaith Alliance, broadcasting from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. And on today's show, my conversations with two very different individuals who both in their own way will leave a significant imprint on American society. Coming up later in the show, I'll speak with Judy Shepherd, mother of slain college student Matthew Shepherd. You know, it's been 11 years, it's hard to believe, 11 years since her son was brutally murdered in Laramie, Wyoming. But today, we'll hear about more than just the headlines surrounding this story, as Judy Shepherd discusses her new memoir and tells us why her son's murder continues to resonate with people.
There's something about Matt, maybe in particular, or the situation that makes people think and wonder what in the world has gone wrong when something like that happens.
My conversation with Judy Shepherd to come. But first, I'm joined now by the man who has been called the most important liberal theologian of the last half century. Harvey Cox is the Hollis Professor of Divinity at Harvard Emeritus, where he has taught for over 40 years. In 1965, Cox published the groundbreaking book, The Secular City, a nuanced defense of secular society against religious fundamentalists, one of our first engagements between Christianity and secularism. And now he's back with a new book. It's not as if he hasn't written some others as well, but this one is called The Future of Faith, a look at how religion is changing today and what these changes mean for the world of tomorrow. Harvey Cox joins me now from his office at Harvard University. I have to tell you, he is a longtime dear friend. Our kind of Baptists have to stick together of necessity.
Right, well.
And it's great to be able to talk to you again. Harvey, welcome to State of Belief.
Well, I'm pleased to be here.
Right off in the book, you identify three qualities that mark the profile of religion in this new millennium: a resurgence of religion, both in public and private, throughout the international community, fundamentalism, and then third, a profound change in the nature of religiousness. I'd like for you to say a word or two about each of those qualities.
Yeah, well, I'll try to make it a word or two. As far as the first one, I don't think that the resurgence of religion that we've witnessed around the world in the last 50 years, despite all of the predictions that religion was dying and going to be marginalized and all that, I don't think it's a blip on the screen. Mm-hmm. I think it is a permanent feature of human life, as long as we're mortal, as long as we band together to seek values and meaning, as long as we have some kind of thirst for a better kind of world, we're going to have religions, for good or for ill, mm-hmm. but they're around to stay. So
people with programs like
the ones you're running are probably going to be in business for a while.
And it's across the ideological spectrum.
Oh, across the denominational and religious tradition spectrum, yeah.
Fundamentalism.
Well, I make the point in this book that often the resurgence of religion and its persistence is confused in people's minds with what they call fundamentalism, and they're not the same. Fundamentalism is a fairly recent phenomenon. It arose in the 19th century, first starting in Protestant Christianity, but then the same term was applied to other traditions. It's a reaction against some very important underlying changes that are going on in religion. And in my view, it's really about come to the end of its string. The fundamentalists are still very noisy. They like to call attention to themselves, but their position in the culture, in the society, and in religion in general is declining. And I don't think that we should anticipate that fundamentalism is going to be that big a presence. Although, you know, it takes something a long time to die sometimes.
Yeah.
And sometimes an animal that's thrashing in its death throes is something you better watch out for. But I think that's what's happening.
Harvey, there is another statement in the book that just captivated me. As you peer into the future, you write, Christianity has a second chance. How so? And did it blow its first chance?
It came pretty close to blowing its first chance, yeah. I think the big, as you'll see in the book, any of your listeners who read it, I think we took a very, very wrong turn early in the 4th century, in the 300s, when with Constantine we allowed Christianity to be really, in a way, drawn in to becoming the ideology of empire.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, Christians were growing, were vigorous, were spreading around the Mediterranean world, had no unifying creed, had no single liturgy, had no hierarchy, but it was the emperor, Constantine, who insisted that you had to have all those things. One of the things that has been helpful is our discovery in the last years, mainly through the very rich archaeological and scroll finds like Nag Hammadi and so on, how enormously varied early Christianity was. It wasn't a single entity, but it got transformed into a hierarchy with a creed, and that lasted for a very long time. Now, there were some very good things happening over all those hundreds of years, but still, it was stifling. What we now see is Christianity coming out of this Constantinian period. Part of that has to do with the real growth area in Christianity is not in Europe and the United States. It's in the non-Western world. That's where things are really happening and where the demographic growth of Christianity is taking place. That's the second chance that we have.
I'm speaking today with Harvey Cox, professor and leading religious thinker, author of the new book, The Future of Faith. There's a lot more to come after a short break. I hope you'll stay tuned because I'm going to ask Harvey about a statement he made about Jews and Christians who come to deny God. They'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Getty. My guest today is Harvey Cox, one of the most important writers on and about religion today. His new book is called The Future of Faith. Harvey, thanks for sticking around.
Oh, great to be here, Welton.
Now, I want to do just what I promised I would, and this is a sentence from your book. Jews and Christians who come to deny the existence of God inevitably deny the God they learned about through the Jewish or Christian tradition. Please talk about that.
Yeah, well, a friend of mine says when he meets somebody who claims to be an atheist, he says, would you please describe the God you don't believe in? Because I probably don't believe in that one either. And it seems to me that people internalize or have sort of written on their brains a particular image of God. Sometimes they get it from their childhood, Jewish or Christian or Buddhist or whatever upbringing, and they never mature in their view of God, of the reality of God. And when they decide, as some of them do, to deny God in one way or another. It's that God that they're denying. What I'm saying there is that atheism, Paul Tillich used to say, my great teacher here at Harvard, Paul, atheism is always the shadow of a particular religion. Hmm. And as we grow, as we get older, we mature, or should mature in our view of the greatness and mystery of God. We come to realize that God is far beyond our definitions, our doctrines, our descriptions of God, and we don't presume to think that we know it all.
Harvey, you write passionately, and you just mentioned it in the last segment, the harm that came to Christianity because of Emperor Constantine's takeover of the structures and beliefs of Christianity, really to advance his own political agenda. I tend to think that unless we get this relationship between religion and government, at least the institutions, worked out, we're going to have continued trouble with credibility and integrity. How important is it, in your mind, for all religions to get straight this relationship with civil authorities?
Oh, I think it's immensely important. And for both the civil authority and for religion, if once they begin to be fused or wedded, it's terrible for politics, because politics gets self-righteous and it's terrible for religion, because religion gets a kind of sniff of the kind of power that you shouldn't be exercising mm-hmm. as a religious person or religious entity. Especially in Christianity and Judaism, the role of the faith community is to be the loyal opposition, the critics of what might contributing to the community we live in and to the nation and society, but not allowing ourselves either to be taken over by it or to try to impose ourselves on it. It's a very important relationship to get right. And we're constantly slipping in the wrong direction. I have to be reminded. And I'm glad we have the First Amendment of the Constitution there to remind us about it.
Harvey, after all these years of teaching and traveling, studying religion, what are, in looking back, what are the major changes in religion that you've seen?
I was just thinking about that today because I was meeting with a group of students here and reflecting back. They asked me almost the same question. And I said, to me, it focuses on people, the changes that I've seen. And the two people who come to my mind in the whole wide world of religion are Gandhi and Martin Luther King. Both of them very, very religious, spiritual people. Gandhi, enormously influenced by Jesus, by the Sermon on the Mount, although Gandhi never became a Christian. King, enormously influenced by Gandhi and also by the, of course, primarily by Jesus and the gospel. But both of them seeing that the religious tradition of which they were a part had to be brought to bear on the thirst that people have for what King called the beloved community, the place where the kind of community where people take care of each other, where they don't try to cut each other down, where cooperation rather than cutthroat competition is the way we live. I think the most hopeful sign, as I talk to students here, for example, at Harvard Divinity School and the students I teach as undergraduates, is they catch this communitarian and justice-oriented dimension of Christianity more clearly than I think maybe my parents did or even I did mm-hmm. when I was that age. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very, very important and for me, very welcome change.
Well, let me ask you a similar question, but in a more personal way. When you look back to the young Harvey Cox who wrote the incredibly popular and good book, The Secular City. How has Harvey Cox changed since then?
Well, I've gotten a little older.
we all have.
That was 45 years ago. Mm-hmm. The original title of The Secular City, most people don't know this, was God in the Secular City. And the publisher said, no, don't call it that. Just call it The Secular City. Because the thesis of the book is that God is present in other social institutions and movements, in the family, in civic affairs, in culture, and not simply in explicitly religious institutions. Now, I don't think that's a new idea. That's very, very biblical, that God is present in all of things, mm-hmm. in nature as well, and to be discerned and responded to. And therefore, we shouldn't be panicked in the changes and what then even appeared at times to be a decline in religious institutions as such, mm-hmm. Because God was still operating in the world, and there'd be new ways to respond. Now, I think I underestimated the capacity of religions and religious institutions to change and to adapt and to find new ways to respond to God's presence in the world. And I think that was a flawed element of that book. But the basic thesis of the book, I would certainly stay with.
Looking to the future, are you hopeful or are you pessimistic?
I'm hopeful. My wife says I'm just a congenitally hopeful person, but I think regardless of things that are going wrong or going downhill, I think for me as a Christian, I have confidence that God is still ultimately in charge, and that right will eventually emerge from wrong. It may take a long time. It takes patience. It takes endurance. But the main thing that cheers me up is I work all the time with younger people mm-hmm. who renew my sense of hope and idealism if it begins to get a little jaded.
My guest is my friend Harvey Cox. The new book that he has written is called The Future of Faith. Harvey, it's great to catch up with you again, and thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
Well, I'm glad to be caught up with, and I'll see you when you're around here again.
Okay. I'm Welton Getty. This is State of Belief. We've got to take a short break right now, but there's a lot more to come on today's show. And up next, my conversation with Judy Shepherd. She's the mother of Matthew Shepherd, the young gay man who was brutally murdered in Laramie, Wyoming, 11 years ago this month. Judy will speak with me about her new memoir about her son, and we'll also take a look at how she was transformed from the victim of a hate crime into one of the country's leading gay rights activists. Stay tuned. We're coming right back. Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Getty. On October 6, 1998, a young man named Matthew Shepherd was brutally beaten and left for dead in the small town of Laramie, Wyoming. Local authorities concluded that Matthew had been targeted because he was gay. When he died on October 12th, his vicious murder was covered by every major network and newspaper around the country. A reminder to the American people about how homophobia can erupt into violence. This month marks 11 years since Matthew's death, and his story still resonates with people. His murder was retold in the play The Laramie Project, and his death has propelled activists around the country, myself included, to lobby for comprehensive hate crimes legislation. While working on the issue, I was fortunate to meet and get to know Matthew's mother, Judy Shepherd, a dedicated spokeswoman for the Matthew Shepherd Act. And now, Judy is the author of a new book, a memoir called The Meaning of Matthew, My Son's Murder in Laramie and A World Transformed. Judy says she wrote the book so that the readers could understand that there was more to her son than just the public figure of Matthew Shepherd. I recently spoke with Judy, and I asked her to tell me about her son, Matt.
Matt was to us a funny, smart, happy, very entertaining young man, determined to make something of his life in public service, and loved the theater.
When you decided, well, let me ask you this. When did you decide to write this book?
It was about 3 years ago, I think. I had first wanted to do a book of letters that had been sent to us while Matt was in the hospital and soon after his death. They were such beautiful, heartfelt letters, and I wanted to share them with everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And I, by accident, had met a book agent who suggested maybe I should do one about the last 10 years before I did one of the letters.
Uh-huh.
So I had to think about it for a while. I wasn't sure I was ready to do that, but I knew somebody who could help me write the book. And sometimes, you know, the universe speaks to you.
Yeah.
And that's when we decided to go ahead and do the book.
You learned of Matt's murder while you and your husband were actually in Saudi Arabia for your husband's job. So you knew very little about the circumstances of his murder. It wasn't until you landed back in the States that you saw the amount of press coverage and the mention of Matt's sexuality as a motive in the crime. Can you describe what that experience was like for you?
Oh, it was absolutely like nothing you might ever think would happen to you. All of a sudden, your private family life is all across national news and newspapers. It was actually international news as well. It was quite surreal. Begin to wonder what on earth has made this interesting to anybody except his family and maybe the area where he lives. It was just unbelievable and kind of scary because up until lately, any news about someone in the gay community is always sensationalized and sort of, you know, made kind of ugly.
Mm-hmm. One of my reasons for inquisitiveness about all of that is that you come back and there is the shock of what happened to him, and then there's the further shock of learning all the details and public reactions, and you didn't have time to even process all of this in your own head. How long did that take? I'm sure that was not all done before the funeral.
Oh, no. We actually knew very little details of what was happening until afterward. We went back to Laramie from Casper to actually clean out Matt's apartment, and that's when we found out the details from the Laramie Police Department. And I'm not sure even then that we really could absorb everything that was happening. It became a year-long learning process about both of the young men and the actual crime before we knew many of the things that had happened. It's shocking. I think I look back and it still seems, you know, beyond the scope of anyone's worst nightmare, I guess, in retrospect.
How did you begin to realize that this wasn't just a private story about Matt, that it was something that had a great impact on the country? When did you realize that?
Well, I guess probably from everyday man emailing us at the hospital, that was pretty astounding. But then when people like Elton John started calling the hospital and Katie Couric wanting to interview us and all the national news networks and papers trying to get in touch with us, probably one of the most bizarre things that happened was movie producers starting to call us while Matt was in the hospital.
Hmm.
That was very strange.
Did that seem like harassment to you, or was there comfort in that?
No, there wasn't comfort. It actually seemed kind of ridiculous to us.
Yeah.
I don't think we took much of it seriously until later. We, Actually, I think we kept thinking it was just going to kind of blow over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 90 days, they're going to move on to the next sensational story. I don't know why it's still... I honestly don't know why it's still in the news. There's something about Matt, maybe in particular, or the situation that that makes people think and wonder what in the world has gone wrong when something like that happens.
Yeah. I don't want to dwell on the trial, but there are two points that you make in the story about religious groups interfering with the trial. You talk about the Catholic Church publishing ads to persuade the jury against the death penalty for the killers, and then the absolutely despicable display of hatred perpetuated by Fred Phelps of the Westboro Baptist Church. And frankly, I have to tell you, I've stopped thinking about that as a religious group. Did this turn you against religion?
Oh no, no. I don't know. I grew up Episcopalian. I am a practicing Episcopalian, and never more proud to be one right now that we have a gay bishop making inroads into the prejudice in the world of religion, organized religion. Fred Phelps is just kind of a sad character in his own little world, and I knew that the Catholic Church was going to be an issue when it came to the trial. They, in Laramie, they have a history of that. They've done it before, so nothing was a surprise. And nothing really turns me against religion in general. I just know that there are these kinds of things just happen. At the trials, we also had groups protesting that those two young men should have been executed. It was a pro-death penalty organization. I can't ever remember what it was called. You just can't imagine the kinds of things that turned out that day.
I'm talking with Judy Shepherd about her new book and the experiences which gave rise to it. Her book is called The Meaning of Matthew, My Son's Murder in Laramie, and A World Transformed. We'll be right back. Welcome back to State of Belief, everybody. I'm talking with Judy Shepherd. I'm Welton Gaddy. Judy, welcome back to State of Belief.
Thank you, Welton.
At the time of Matt's death and the subsequent trial, there were many civil rights groups that linked Matt's death to the need for an expanded hate crimes legislation that protected gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered Americans. This is an issue on which you and I have been to Capitol Hill, you more than I, but we have sat together and talked to members of Congress. I know your opinions changed somewhat and solidified about hate crimes. Can you tell our listeners what kind of changes went on in you about that?
Well, I'd really never had much experience with hate crime or legislation. I was a child of the 60s, and I was very well aware of the civil rights movement, watching the horrendous things happening on television. And then when the gay community became a part of my world, you began to see in the press that the only time they ever talked about the gay community was out of fear, discrimination, hate, the AIDS pandemic. And I understood then that these kinds of crimes that I had witnessed happening in the African-American community were happening in the United States and around the world in regard to the gay community as well. And now, having been a victim of a hate crime by the death of my son, I understand now that the reaction to that, to a hate crime, is different than a crime not involved in the issue of hate specifically. Those kinds of crimes are meant to terrorize the community, not just the individual or the individual's family, but the entire community. And it's a much different... It's a much different feeling, a much different environment, atmosphere, when a crime is committed based solely on the hate of the individual for who they are.
I know that your life changed when you met a representative from the Human Rights Council. They wanted you to do what you're doing now. At the time, I think you didn't know whether you had the capacity to do that. Was it a little fearsome stepping out, and has confidence just grown and grown because it seems to have?
I was not fearful of speaking out about the issues, only that I didn't know that much about them. But I had never been put in that kind of position before. I wasn't really sure I could do that. So they sort of, the Human Rights Campaign sort of educated me, helped me along, gave me some confidence, and definitely an education. And when I found when I actually did start to speak out that it was okay. I could talk about my family and talk about Matt, and it was like talking to my friends in my living room. Walton, I'm sure you're familiar with how important a cause becomes to you. It becomes easy to talk about like it's your family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tell me how you feel. You know, the House of Representatives passed a standalone hate crimes bill earlier this year. Are you as hopeful as I am about that, or how are you feeling about it?
I am hopeful. It's also passed the Senate, but attached to the Department of Defense bill, which is always a little squishy. It's in conference now, and we're waiting for Congress to be back in session and decide what it is they're going to do now. It needs to be reconciled with the House, and I believe the Senate again. And then we'll go to the president's desk, and we're confident that the president will sign it. He has said many times he definitely supports it. He voted for it when he was in the Senate. The issue now is it just really going to come out of conference still attached to the Department of Defense bill.
Mm-hmm. Today, you speak very publicly about your son's death and about the need for equality and rights for the LGBT community. In the epilogue to the book, you write that people often ask you, how did you do what you do? A question that you admit is hard for you to answer. I want to ask another question, closely related. Why do you do what you do?
Well, that's a. I'm not sure I can explain that in 10 words or less. It was a family decision. As I said earlier, we felt we had a window of opportunity where people might remember Matt's name, what happened to Matt and Matt's family. And we thought if we could make just the least bit of difference among the community for Matt's friends and the people of his community, that we owed that to Matt. We couldn't help Matt anymore. But maybe we had the capacity to help his friends and community. We would have gone crazy had we done nothing. That doesn't work for everybody, but it worked for us. And we certainly had help along the way with folks like yourself, with the Human Rights Campaign and other organizations and political figures from all walks of life. It was a decision that was kind of made for us, I think.
As people read your book, they're going to know of its benefits to them. I'm curious, what did writing the book do to you?
Well, it was really hard. I didn't think it was going to be that hard, but it was hard to go back to those memories of 11 years ago and recall all the details and try to put them in the proper order. It was sort of a family therapeutic session, I guess. What it did for me was bring home to me how little things have changed over the last 11 years. My husband calls it progress and no change. We've made progress at the grassroots level for the gay and lesbian community, but legislatively and legally, not so much. So it really brought home to me how we're just kind of, you know, we're kind of treading water here. And we thought we would be further along in the cause by now. On a personal level, it brought Matt back home to me. And it sort of taught me something about myself, too. Maybe I wasn't as ill-prepared to do this as I thought I was in the beginning. Certainly my message has changed. I think I'm a little more angry now than I was then, angry that things have not gotten better for the gay community.
Well, Judy, you mentioned a while ago that a lot of the interest and attention that has continued to be devoted to the death of Matt and to what you're doing is because of the special nature of Matt. I would agree with that, but I also know it has something to do with the special nature of Matt's mother. And that gets captured in the last paragraph of your book. I'd like to read that paragraph.
Okay.
Dennis and I will eventually live together in Casper again, and our days will be filled with friends, family, and our memories of Matt. At night, after everyone's gone home, the two of us will sit in the living room, warmed by the light of the same setting sun and invigorated by the sound of the same whipping wind that's kept my family coming back to Wyoming all these years. If you take nothing else away from my story, please take away the fact that we loved Matt for Matt's sake. As Dennis once said in a speech he gave in Washington, D.C., and I paraphrase here, Matt was not our gay son. Matt was our son who happened to be gay. What do you feel when you hear those words?
Wow, that's hard. Being gay is not what defined Matt. He happened to be gay, but the definition of who he was what was in his heart. Caring for other people.
And Judy, I have to say that all that you do is to be affirmed, but that's not what defines you.
Thank you.
You're defined by who you are. And those of us who know you love and appreciate who you are.
Thank you, Walton.
Judy Shepherd is Matthew Shepherd's mother. She's the author of the new book, The Meaning of Matthew, My Son's Murder in Laramie, and A World Transformed. I hope you'll read it and be a part of the transforming of the world. Judy, please tell people where they can find information on the Matthew Shepherd Foundation.
We have two websites, MatthewShepherd.org. You just need to be careful how you spell Matthew and Shepherd, and MatthewsPlace.com.
Judy, thanks so much for spending this time with us on State of Belief.
Thank you, Walton. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Okay, take care.
Thank you.
Well, friends, that's our show for this week. You want to get in touch? I really hope you do, because we want to be in touch with you. Write to us. Go to stateofbelief.com and click on the Contact Us page. Or you can call us at 202-238-3291. That's 202-238-3291. Tell us what you're thinking. We want to know what's in your head about the show or about anything else that's on your mind. State of Belief is brought to you each week by Interfaith Alliance. If you want to get involved in the cause for religious liberty, then join the Interfaith Alliance. Become a member. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. Now, we'll be right back here on State of Belief next week. You can count on it. There will be more stories from the intersection of religion and politics. There will be new names to mention and quotes to repeat. But until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief. Religion and radio done differently.